or exploit ethnic discord in Transylvania. The same could not be said, however, of the Serbs and the Kingdom of Serbia after 1903. Just over 40% of the population of Bosnia-Herzegovina were Serbs, and there were large areas of Serbian settlement in the Vojvodina, in southern Hungary, and smaller ones in Croatia-Slavonia. After the regicide of 1903, Belgrade stepped up the pace of irredentist activity within the empire, focusing in particular on Bosnia-Herzegovina. In February 1906, the Austrian military attaché in Belgrade, Pomiankovsky, summarized the problem in a letter to the chief of the general staff. It was certain, Pomiankovsky declared, that Serbia would number among the empire's enemies in the event of a future military conflict. The problem was less the attitude of the government as such than the ultra-nationalist orientation of the political culture as a whole. Even if a sensible government were at the helm, Pomiankovsky warned, it would be in no position to prevent the all-powerful radical chauvinists from launching an adventure. More dangerous, however, than Serbia's open enmity and its miserable army was the fifth-column work of the Serbian radicals in peacetime, which systematically poisons the attitude of our South Slav population and could, if the worst came to the worst, create very serious difficulties for our army. The chauvinist irredentism of the Serbian state, or more precisely, of the most influential political forces within it, came to occupy a central place in Vienna's assessments of the relationship with Belgrade. The official instructions composed in the summer of 1907 by Foreign Minister Count Alois von Aerenthal for the new Austrian envoy to Serbia convey a sense of how relations had deteriorated since the regicide. Under King Milan, Aerenthal recalled, the Serbian crown had been strong enough to counteract any public Bosnian agitation, but since the events of July 1903, everything had changed. It was not just that King Petar was politically too weak to oppose the forces of chauvinist nationalism, but rather that he had himself begun to exploit the national movement in order to consolidate his position. One of the foremost tasks of the new Austrian minister in Belgrade would therefore be the close observation and analysis of Serbian nationalist activity. When the opportunity arose, the minister was to inform King Petar and Prime Minister Pašić that he was fully acquainted with the scope and character of pan-Serb nationalist activity. The leaders in Belgrade should be left in no doubt that Austria-Hungary regarded its occupation of Bosnia-Herzegovina as definitive. Above all, the minister was not to be put off by the usual official denials. It is to be expected that they will respond to your well-meant warnings with the time-honored cliché that the Serbian politicians always roll out when they are reproached with their furtive machinations vis-à-vis the occupied provinces. The Serbian government strives to maintain correct and blameless relations, but is in no position to hold back the sentiment of the nation, which demands action, etc., etc. Aerenthal's official instruction captures the salient features of Vienna's attitude to Belgrade, a belief in the primordial power of Serbian nationalism, a visceral distrust of the leading statesman, and a deepening anxiety over the future of Bosnia, concealed behind a pose of lofty and invulnerable superiority. The scene was thus set for the annexation of Bosnia and Herzegovina in 1908. There had never been any doubt, either in Austria or in the chancelleries of the other great powers, that Vienna regarded the occupation of 1878 as permanent. In one of the secret articles of the renewed Three Emperors Alliance of 1881, Austria-Hungary had explicitly asserted the right to annex these provinces at whatever moment she shall deem opportune, and this claim was repeated at intervals in Austro-Russian diplomatic agreements. Nor was it contested in principle by Russia, though St. Petersburg reserved the right to impose conditions when the moment for such a change of status arrived. The advantages to Austria-Hungary of a formal annexation were obvious enough. It would remove any doubt about the future of the provinces, a matter of some urgency since the occupation statute agreed at the Congress of Berlin was due to expire in 1908. It would allow Bosnia and Herzegovina to be integrated more fully into the political fabric of the empire, through the establishment, for example, of a provincial parliament. It would create a more stable environment for inward investment. More importantly, it would signal to Belgrade and to the Serbs in Bosnia-Herzegovina the permanence of Austria-Hungary's possession, and thus, in theory at least, remove one incentive for further agitation. Erenthal, who became foreign minister in November 1906, also had other reasons for pressing ahead. Until around the turn of the century, he had been a staunch supporter of the dualist system. But his faith in the compromise was shaken in 1905 by the bitter infighting between the Austrian and Hungarian political elites over the administration of the joint armed forces. By 1907, he had come to favour a tripartite solution to the monarchy's problems. The two dominant power centres within the monarchy would be supplemented by a third entity incorporating the South Slavs, above all Croats, Slovenes and Serbs. This was a programme with a considerable following among the South Slav elites, especially the Croats, who resented being divided between Cisleitania, the Kingdom of Hungary, and the province of Croatia-Slavonia, ruled from Budapest. Only if Bosnia-Herzegovina were fully annexed to the empire would it be possible eventually to incorporate it into the structure of a reformed trialist monarchy. And this, in turn, such was Erenthal's devout hope, would provide an internal counterweight to the irredentist activities of Belgrade. Far from being the piedmont of South Slavdom in the Balkans, Serbia would become the severed limb of a vast, Croat-dominated South Slav entity within the empire. The clinching argument for annexation was the Young Turk Revolution that broke out in Ottoman Macedonia in the summer of 1908. The Young Turks forced the Sultan in Constantinople to proclaim a constitution and the establishment of a parliament. They planned to subject the Ottoman imperial system to a root-and-branch reform. Rumours circulated to the effect that the new Turkish leadership would shortly call general elections throughout the Ottoman Empire, including the areas occupied by Austria-Hungary, which currently possessed no representative organs of their own. What if the new Turkish administration, its legitimacy and confidence enhanced by the revolution, were to demand the return of its lost western salient, and to woo its inhabitants with the promise of constitutional reform? Hoping to capitalize on these uncertainties, an opportunist Muslim-Serb coalition emerged in Bosnia, calling for autonomy under Turkish suzerainty. There was now the danger that an ethnic alliance within the province might join forces with the Turks to push the Austrians out. In order to forestall any such complications, Erenthal moved quickly to prepare the ground for annexation. The Ottomans were bought out of their nominal sovereignty with a handsome indemnity. Much more important were the Russians, upon whose acquiescence the whole project depended. Erenthal was a firm believer in the importance of good relations with Russia. As Austrian ambassador in St. Petersburg during the years 1899 to 1906, he had helped to consolidate the Austro-Russian rapprochement. Securing the agreement of the Russian foreign minister, Alexander Izvolsky, was easy. The Russians had no objection to the formalization of Austria-Hungary's status in Bosnia-Herzegovina, provided St. Petersburg received something in return. Indeed, it was Izvolsky, with the support of Tsar Nicholas II, who proposed that the annexation of Bosnia-Herzegovina be exchanged for Austrian support for improved Russian access to the Turkish Straits. On the 16th of September 1908, Izvolsky and Erenthal clarified the terms of the deal at Schloss Buchlau, the Moravian estate of Leopold von Berchtold, Austro-Hungarian ambassador in St. Petersburg. In a sense, therefore, the annexation of 1908 was born out of the spirit of the Austro-Russian Balkan Entente. There was, moreover, a neat symmetry about the exchange, since Izvolsky and Erenthal were essentially after the same thing— gains that would be secured through secret negotiations at the expense of the Ottoman Empire and in contravention of the Treaty of Berlin. Despite these preparations, Erenthal's announcement of the annexation on the 5th of October 1908 triggered a major European crisis. Izvolsky denied having reached any agreement with Aerenthal. He subsequently even denied that he had been advised in advance of Aerenthal's intentions, and demanded that an international conference be convened to clarify the status of Bosnia-Herzegovina. The resulting crisis dragged on for months, as Serbia, Russia, and Austria mobilized and counter-mobilized, and Aerenthal continued to evade Izvolsky's call for a conference that had not been foreseen in the agreement at Buchlau. The issue was resolved only by the St. Petersburg Note of March 1909, in which the Germans demanded that the Russians at last recognize the annexation and urge Serbia to do likewise. If they did not, Chancellor Bülow warned, then things would take their course. This formulation hinted not just at the possibility of an Austrian war on Serbia, but, more importantly, at the possibility that the Germans would release the documents proving Izvolsky's complicity in the original annexation deal. Izvolsky immediately backed down. Aerenthal has traditionally carried the lion's share of the responsibility for the annexation crisis. Is this fair? To be sure, the Austrian foreign minister's maneuvers lacked diplomatic transparency. He chose to operate with the tools of the old diplomacy, confidential meetings, the exchange of pledges and secret bilateral agreements, rather than attempting to resolve the annexation issue through an international conference involving all the signatories of the Treaty of Berlin. This preference for furtive arrangements made it easier for Izvolsky to claim that he, and by extension Russia, had been hoodwinked by the slippery Austrian minister. Yet the evidence suggests that the crisis took the course that it did, because Izvolsky lied in the most extravagant fashion in order to save his job and reputation. The Russian foreign minister had made two serious errors of judgment. He had assumed, firstly, that London would support his demand for the opening of the Turkish Straits to Russian warships. He had also grossly underestimated the impact of the annexation on Russian nationalist opinion. According to one account, he was initially perfectly calm when news of the annexation reached him in Paris on the 8th of October 1908. It was only during his stay in London a few days later, when the British proved uncooperative and he got wind of the press response in St. Petersburg, that he realized his error, panicked, and began to construct himself as Aerenthal's dupe. Whatever the rights and wrongs of Aerenthal's policy, the Bosnian annexation crisis was a turning point in Balkan geopolitics. It devastated what remained of Austro-Russian readiness to collaborate on resolving Balkan questions. From this moment onwards, it would be much more difficult to contain the negative energies generated by conflicts among the Balkan states. It also alienated Austria's neighbor and ally, the Kingdom of Italy. There had long been latent tensions between the two states, Italian minority rights in Dalmatia and Croatia-Slavonia, and power political rivalry in the Adriatic were the two most important bones of contention. But the annexation crisis prompted calls for Italian compensation and kindled Italian resentments to a new pitch of intensity. In the last years before the outbreak of war, it became increasingly difficult to reconcile Italian and Austrian objectives on the Balkan-Adriatic coast. The Germans were initially non-committal on the annexation question, but they soon rallied energetically to Austria-Hungary's support, and this too was an ambivalent development. It had the desired effect of dissuading the Russian government from attempting to extract further capital out of the annexation crisis, but in the longer run, it reinforced the sense in both St. Petersburg and London that Austria was the satellite of Berlin, a perception that would play a dangerous role in the crisis of 1914. In Russia, the impact of the crisis was especially deep and lasting. Defeat in the war with Japan in 1904-5 had shut off the prospect of Far Eastern expansion for the foreseeable future. The Anglo-Russian Convention, signed by Izvolsky and the British ambassador Sir Arthur Nicholson on the 31st of August 1907, had established the limits of Russian influence in Persia, Afghanistan, and Tibet. The Balkans remained, for the moment, the only arena in which Russia could still pursue a policy focused on projecting imperial power. Intense public emotions were invested in Russia's status as protector of the lesser Slavic peoples, and underlying these in the minds of the key decision-makers was a deepening preoccupation with the question of access to the Turkish Straits. Misled by Izvolsky and fired up by chauvinist popular emotion, the Russian government and public opinion interpreted the annexation as a brutal betrayal of the understanding between the two powers, an unforgivable humiliation and an unacceptable provocation in a sphere of vital interest. In the years that followed the Bosnian crisis, the Russians launched a program of military investment so substantial that it triggered a European arms race. There were also signs of a deeper Russian political involvement with Serbia. In the autumn of 1909, the Russian Foreign Ministry appointed Nikolai Hartvig, a fiery fanatic in the old Slavophile tradition, to the Russian embassy in Belgrade. Once in office, Hartvig, an energetic and intelligent envoy, worked hard to push Belgrade into taking up a more assertive position against Vienna. Indeed, he pushed so hard in this direction that he sometimes exceeded the instructions of his managers in St. Petersburg. Lies and forgeries. The annexation crisis also further poisoned relations between Vienna and Belgrade. As so often, the situation was exacerbated by political conditions inside the dual monarchy. For several years, the Austro-Hungarian authorities had been observing the activities of the Serbo-Croat coalition, a political faction that emerged within the Croatian Diet at Agram, today Zagreb, capital of Hungarian-ruled Croatia-Slavonia, in 1905. After the Diet elections of 1906, the coalition secured control of the Agram administration, embraced a Yugoslav agenda seeking a closer union of the South Slav peoples within the empire, and fought long battles with the Hungarian authorities over such ticklish issues as the requirement that all state railway officials should be able to speak Magyar. There was nothing especially unusual about this constellation. What worried the Austrians was the suspicion that some or all of the deputies of the coalition might be operating as a fifth column for Belgrade. During the crisis of 1908-9, these apprehensions escalated to the point of paranoia. In March 1909, just as Russia was backing down from a confrontation over Bosnia, the Habsburg administration launched an astonishingly inept judicial assault on the Serbo-Croat coalition, charging 53 mainly Serb activists with treason for plotting to detach the South Slav lands from Austria-Hungary and join them to Serbia. At around the same time, the Vienna-based historian and writer Dr. Heinrich Friedjung published an article in the Neue Freie Presse accusing three prominent coalition politicians of receiving subsidies from Belgrade in return for treasonous activity on behalf of the Kingdom of Serbia. Friedjung claimed to have been shown confidential government documents demonstrating beyond doubt the truth of these charges. The treason trial at Agram dragged on from the 3rd of March until the 5th of November 1909 and quickly collapsed into an unmitigated public relations disaster for the government. The court heard 276 witnesses for the prosecution, but none who had been nominated by the defense. All 31 convictions handed down in Agram were subsequently quashed on appeal in Vienna. At the same time, a chain of libel trials against Friedjung and the editor of the Reichspost, which had reprinted his claims, revealed further embarrassing manipulations. The secret documents on which the good doctor had based his charges turned out to be forgeries passed to the Austrian legation in Belgrade by a shady Serbian double agent, and supplied in turn to Friedjung by the Foreign Ministry in Vienna. The unfortunate Friedjung, whose excellent reputation as an historian had been shamefully misused, apologized and withdrew his accusations. But the tireless Czech national activist and advocate for the accused, Tomáš Masaryk, continued to pursue the matter at the highest level, searching far and wide, including in Belgrade, for new evidence and claiming in various public forums that the Austrian ambassador in Belgrade had knowingly procured the forgeries on Count Aerenthal's behalf. It is highly unlikely that the authorities in Vienna knew from the outset that the documents were inauthentic. Paranoia probably engendered credulity. The Austrians were primed to believe what they feared to find. But the Agrum and Friedjung trials imposed a lasting burden on relations between Vienna and Belgrade. Particularly awkward was the fact that the scandal soon began to focus on the Austrian representative in Serbia, Johann Count Forgach von Gimesch and Gach, with far-reaching consequences for the diplomatic relationship between the two countries. Throughout 1910 and 1911, the Masaryk campaign continued to produce new and embarrassing revelations of Austrian perfidy, not all of which were true. The Serbian press rejoiced, and there were loud demands for Forgach's recall from Belgrade. But Forgach, who had long since ceased to take any pleasure whatsoever in his posting, vigorously and probably truthfully denied all charges, and Ehrenthal, who was himself under attack, felt unable to remove the embattled envoy for as long as this might imply an acknowledgement from Vienna that the Austrian authorities had deliberately deceived the public. "The situation is not pleasant for me," Forgach wrote in a private letter to the Foreign Office section chief in Vienna in November 1910, "but I will survive the Belgrade newspaper storms, as I have survived so much else, provided the government here behaves in a halfway decent fashion." What especially infuriated Forgach was the continuing involvement of senior Serbian officials, foremost among them the Foreign Office section chief Miroslav Spalajković, in the campaign to discredit him. Spalajković provided Masaryk with evidence against the Austrian government. He was even called as an expert witness on behalf of the Serbo-Croat coalition during the Friedjung trials. Having helped to explode the credibility of the forged documents, Spalajković went a step further and asserted that Forgach had deliberately secured them in the hope of trumping up charges against the Serbo-Croat coalition. In the winter of 1910-11, the Dutch envoy in Belgrade, Vredenburg, reported that Spalajković continued to disseminate rumours against the Austrian representative across the diplomatic community. To make matters worse, Spalajković and his wife were constantly to be seen in the company of Hartwig, the new Russian minister. Indeed, it was said that the couple virtually lived at the Russian mission. Forgach became unhealthily obsessed with the man he called our deadly enemy. An exchange of curt letters between the envoy and the official further poisoned relations between them, and by April 1911, Forgach had ordered all personnel at the Austrian legation in Belgrade to avoid contact of any kind with Spalajković. "This constantly overwrought man," he informed Ehrenthal, "is in some respects not entirely sane. Since the annexation, his hatred for the Austro-Hungarian monarchy has developed almost into a mental illness." Forgach's position in Belgrade had clearly become untenable, and he was recalled in the summer of 1911. But the scandal of the Agram-Friedjung trials and their aftermath in the Serbian capital are worth recalling because they involved individuals who would figure prominently in the events of 1914. Miroslav Spalajković was a very senior foreign policy official with a long-standing interest in Bosnia-Herzegovina. His wife was a Bosnian, and he had composed a doctoral thesis at the University of Paris in 1897, arguing that, as the two provinces remained autonomous legal entities under Ottoman suzerainty, their annexation by Austria-Hungary could never be legitimate. He subsequently served as the Serbian minister in Sofia, where he played an important role, in collusion with the Russians, in forging the Serbian-Bulgarian alliance at the centre of the Balkan League that launched the First Balkan War in 1912. During his posting at Sofia, he remained Nikolai Hartwig's most intimate friend, visiting him in Belgrade up to 20 times a month. He was subsequently transferred to the even more important legation in St. Petersburg. Here his task would be to interpret the intentions of the Tsar and his ministers to the Serbian government in Belgrade as the crisis of July 1914 unfolded. Forgach, too, who left his posting as a staunch Serbophobe, remained on the scene as one of the leading figures in a cohort of officials who helped shape the policies of the Austro-Hungarian Foreign Ministry after the sudden death of Aerenthal from leukemia in 1912. And we should not forget the bitter personal animosity between Izvolsky and Aerenthal, which was rightly identified by the Vienna Quality Press in the aftermath of the Bosnian crisis as an impediment to the improvement of relations between Austria-Hungary and Russia. It is a curious feature of the July crisis of 1914 that so many of the key actors in it had known each other for so long. Beneath the surface of many of the key transactions lurked personal antipathies and long-remembered injuries. The Serbian problem was not a matter that the Austrians could handle in isolation. It was embedded within a complex of interlocked questions. First, there was the pressing issue of Serbia's relationship with Russia, which was closer after the annexation crisis than it had been before. Vienna was deeply suspicious of the Russian minister Hartwig, whose Austrophobia, pan-Slavism, and growing influence in Belgrade augured ill for the future. Hartwig, the French minister in Sofia reported, was the archetype of the true mujik, a partisan of the old Russian-Turkish policy, who was prepared to sacrifice the Far East for the Balkans. Hartwig established relations of extraordinary intimacy with Prime Minister Nikola Pašić. The two men met almost daily. "Your beard is consulting with our beard," the officials of the Serbian Foreign Ministry would comment to the junior diplomats of the Russian mission. "No one," a Russian staffer commented, "believed that secrets were possible in relation to the political goals shared by Russia and Serbia." The Russian minister was greeted everywhere in Belgrade like a conquering hero. People just needed to see his characteristic head and he would get standing ovations. Vienna could, in theory, offset Serbian hostility by seeking better relations with Bulgaria. But pursuing this option also entailed difficulties. Since there was still a bitter dispute over the border between Bulgaria and Romania, cozying up to Sofia brought the risk of alienating Bucharest. A hostile Bucharest was extremely undesirable because of the huge Romanian minority in Hungarian Transylvania. If Romania were to turn away from Vienna towards St. Petersburg, the minority issue might well become a question of regional security. Hungarian diplomats and political leaders in particular warned that Greater Romania posed as serious a threat to the dual monarchy as Greater Serbia. A further concern was the little principality of Montenegro on the Adriatic coast. This picturesque, impoverished kingdom provided the backdrop for Franz Lehár's The Merry Widow, where it appeared thinly disguised as the Grand Duchy of Pontevedro. The German libretto gave the game away by explicitly stating that the singers should wear Montenegrin national costume. Montenegro was the smallest of the Balkan states, with a population of only 250,000, scattered across a beautiful but unforgiving terrain of black peaks and plunging ravines. This was a country where the king, dressed in a splendid uniform of gold, silver, red, and blue, could be seen smoking at dusk in front of his palace, hoping to chat with a passerby. When the Prague journalist Egon Erwin Kisch travelled by foot from Cetinje, then the capital of Montenegro, to the beautiful port city of Rijeka, now in Croatia, in the summer of 1913, he was disconcerted to hear gunshots ringing out across the valleys. He wondered at first whether a Balkan war had broken out, but his guard assured him that it was just the Montenegrin youth with their Russian rifles shooting small fish in the fast-flowing mountain streams. Though poor and tiny, Montenegro was not unimportant. Its mountain guns on the Lovchen Heights overlooked the indefensible Austrian harbour facilities at Katero on the Adriatic, to the vexation of Habsburg naval planners. Nikola, the reigning prince since 1861, and thus the third longest-serving European monarch after Queen Victoria and Franz Joseph, was extraordinarily ambitious. He had succeeded in doubling the territory of his kingdom at the Berlin Congress of 1878, expanded it again during the annexation crisis of 1908, and thereafter had his eye on a piece of northern Albania. He elevated himself to the status of king in 1910. He also married off his female offspring with quite extraordinary skill. King Petar Karadjordjevich of Serbia was his son-in-law, though his Montenegrin wife had died by the time Petar was crowned. Another of Nicola's daughters, Elena, married Victor Emmanuel III of Italy, king from 1900. Two others married Russian archdukes in St. Petersburg, where they became prominent figures in Russian high society. Nicola exploited his strategically sensitive position in order to attract funding from powerful foreign sponsors, most importantly Russia. In 1904, he demonstrated his solidarity with the great Slav ally by solemnly declaring war on Japan. The Russians reciprocated with military subsidies and a military mission whose task was the reorganization of the Montenegrin army. Italy, linked through its royal house with Montenegro, was a further complication. Italy had been a member of the Triple Alliance with Austria and Germany since May 1882, and renewed its membership in 1891, 1902, and 1912. But public sentiment on the question of relations with Austria was deeply divided. Broadly speaking, liberal, secular, nationalist Italy tended to favor a policy of confrontation with Austrians, especially in the Adriatic, which Italian nationalists regarded as a natural avenue for the consolidation of Italian influence. Catholic, clerical, conservative Italy tended, by contrast, to favor a policy of rapprochement and collaboration with Vienna. Reflecting these divided loyalties, Rome operated an elaborate, multi-layered, and often contradictory diplomacy. In 1900 and 1902, the Italian government signed secret agreements with France that cancelled out most of its treaty obligations to Vienna and Berlin. From 1904, moreover, the Italians made it increasingly clear that they viewed Austro-Hungarian policy in the Balkans as impinging on their interest in the area. Montenegro was seen as a promising field for the expansion of Italian commercial and cultural influence in the Balkans, and Foreign Minister Tommaso Titoni cultivated very friendly relations with Belgrade and Sofia. The Italians reacted sharply to the annexation of Bosnia in 1908, less because they objected in principle to the Austrian move than because Aerenthal refused to compensate Rome with the foundation of an Italian university in the mainly Italian-speaking Habsburg port of Trieste. In October 1909, King Victor Emmanuel III broke ranks with the Triple Alliance to sign a secret agreement with Tsar Nicholas II. The Racconigi bargain, as it later became known, stipulated that Italy and Russia would not conclude agreements on the European East without each other's consent, and that the two powers pledged to regard with benevolence the one Russia's interest in the matter of the Straits, the other Italian interests in Tripoli and Cyrenaica. The agreement was less momentous than it seemed, for the Italians soon after signed an understanding with Vienna that largely cancelled out the pledges of Racconigi, but it signalled Rome's determination to pursue a more assertive and independent policy. The likeliest apple of future Austro-Italian discord in the Balkans was Albania, still locked within the Ottoman Empire, which both Italy and Austria viewed as falling within their sphere of influence. Since the 1850s, Austria had, through its vice-consulate in Scutari, exercised a kind of religious protectorate over the Catholics in the north of the country. But the Italians, too, took a strong interest in Albania, with its long Adriatic coastline. By the turn of the century, Rome and Vienna had agreed that they would support Albanian independence in the event of a collapse of Ottoman power in the region. The question of how exactly influence would be shared between the two Adriatic powers remained unresolved. Deceptive calm. In March 1909, Serbia formally pledged that it would desist from further covert operations against Austrian territory and maintain good neighborly relations with the empire. In 1910, Vienna and Belgrade even agreed, after much wrangling, a trade treaty ending the Austro-Serbian commercial conflict. A 24% rise in Serbian imports during that year bore witness to improving economic conditions. Austro-Hungarian goods began to reappear on the shelves of shops in Belgrade, and by 1912 the dual monarchy was once again the main buyer and supplier of Serbia. At meetings between Pašić and the Austrian representative, there were assurances of goodwill on both sides. But a deep awkwardness had settled over the two states' relations that seemed impossible to dispel. Although there was talk of an official visit by King Petar to Vienna, it never materialized. On the initially genuine pretext of the monarch's ill health, the Serbian government moved the visit from Vienna to Budapest, then postponed it, and then, in April 1911, put it off indefinitely. Yet, to the chagrin of the Austrians, there was a highly successful royal trip to Paris in the winter of 1911. The French visit was deemed so important that the Serbian envoy in Paris returned to Belgrade to help prepare it. An earlier plan to combine the journey to France with stops in Vienna and Rome was jettisoned. Petar arrived in Paris on the 16th of November and was accommodated in the court of the Quai d'Orsay, where he was welcomed by the President of the Republic and presented with a gold medal, fashioned especially for the occasion, commemorating the King's service as a young Serbian exile and volunteer in the French War of 1870 against Prussia. At a state dinner on the same evening, and to the intense annoyance of the Austrians, President Falière opened his speech by hailing Petar as the King of all the Serbs, including implicitly those living within the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the man who was going to lead his country and people into freedom. Visibly excited, Petar replied that he and his fellow Serbs would count on France in their fight for freedom. Behind the scenes, moreover, the work to redeem Bosnia-Herzegovina for Serbdom continued. Narodna Odbrana, ostensibly converted into a purely cultural organization, soon resumed its former activities. Its branch organizations proliferated after 1909 and spilled over into Bosnia-Herzegovina. The Austrians monitored, as far as they were able, the espionage activity of Serbian agents crossing the border. A characteristic example was a certain Dragomir Djordjevic, a reserve lieutenant in the Serbian army who combined his cultural work as an actor in Bosnia with the management of a covert network of Serb informants. He was spotted returning to Serbia for weapons training in October 1910. Austrian representatives in Serbia were also aware from an early stage of the existence of Ujedinjenje ili Smrt, though they were at first unsure of what they should make of this mysterious newcomer to the Belgrade scene. In a report filed on the 12th of November 1911, the new minister in Belgrade, Forgaci's successor, Stefan von Ugron zu Abranfalva, notified Vienna of the existence of an association supposedly existing in officer circles that was currently the subject of press comment in Serbia. At this point, nothing positive was known about the group, save that it called itself the Black Hand and was chiefly concerned with regaining the influence over national politics that the army had enjoyed in the Obrenović era. Further reports from Ugron and the Austrian military attaché Otto Gelinek fleshed out the picture somewhat. Arpis was now identified as the dominant figure in the new network, and a more elaborate picture emerged of its objectives. The program of the movement consists in the removal of all personalities in the country who stand in the way of the greater Serbian idea, and the enthronement of a leader who will be ready to lead the fight for the unification of all Serbs. Press rumors to the effect that the Black Hand had drawn up a hit list of politicians to be assassinated in the event of a coup against the current radical government, nourished by the mysterious murders of two prominent opposition politicians in the autumn of 1911, were later discounted as false. It appeared, Gelinek reported on the 22nd of November 1911, that the conspirators planned to use legal means to remove the inner enemies of Serbdom in order then to turn with unified force against its external foes. The Austrians initially viewed these developments with surprising equanimity. It was virtually impossible, Gelinek observed, to keep any organization in Serbia secret for long, because for every five conspirators there is one informant. Conspiracies were nothing new in Serbia, after all. The matter was, therefore, of little importance. But the attitude of the Austrian observers changed as they began to grasp the extent of the Black Hand's influence over parts of the state apparatus. In December 1911, the military attaché reported that the Serbian Minister of War had called off an investigation into the movement because there would otherwise be difficulties of far-reaching significance. Early in February 1912, he observed that the network had acquired semi-official character. It appeared that the government was fully informed on all members of the Black Hand and on their activity. The fact that Minister of War Stepanovich, a protector of the organization, remained in office was a sign of its growing political influence. A complex picture emerged that would shape Austrian behavior in the summer of 1914. It was clear on the one hand that Unity or Death was a subversive network, genuinely opposed to and feared by the current civilian authorities in the Kingdom of Serbia. But it was also the case that the great Serbian objectives of the network were widely condoned and supported, both by elements of the civilian leadership and by the broader public in Serbia. More importantly, there were times when the movement and the administration appeared to operate in tandem. In February 1912, Ugrin warned that the Serbian authorities might collaborate with an enthusiastic military patriotic movement, provided its energies could be turned outwards against Serbia's external foes and away from subversive activity within the kingdom itself. The irredentist organ Piemont openly espoused anti-Habsburg ultra-nationalist objectives. By defining itself thus in terms of national goals, Ugrin noted, the Black Hand made it difficult for the Serbian civilian authorities to take action against it. In short, the Austrians grasped both the extent of Black Hand influence and the complexity of the constraints preventing the Pašić government from taking action to counter it. The outlines of this analysis remained in place until the summer of 1914. The Austrians followed as closely as they could the dramatic growth of the network during the Balkan Wars of 1912 and 1913. In January 1914, attention focused on the trial of a regicide officer by the name of Vemić, who had been notorious in 1903 for carrying about with him in a suitcase a desiccated flap of flesh that he had cut from one of Queen Draga's breasts as a trophy of the night of the 11th of June. In October 1913, during the Second Balkan War, Vemić shot dead a Serbian recruit for being too slow to follow an order and was tried by a military tribunal. His acquittal by a court staffed entirely by senior officers triggered uproar in parts of the Belgrade press, and Vemić was called for a retrial before the Serbian Supreme Court. But his sentence, a mere 10 months of imprisonment, was cut short by a royal pardon, extracted by the military leadership from the king at the end of December 1913. "The officer corps is a politically decisive factor in today's Serbia," Gelinek noted in May 1914. This growth in the Praetorian element in Serbian public life in turn represented an enhanced threat to Austria-Hungary, since the officer corps is also the bastion of the great Serbian extreme Austrophobe tendency. The most enigmatic ingredient in the mix was Nikola Pašić, the uncrowned king of Serbia. Pašić held his fire during the political storms of 1913-14 and refused to allow himself to be provoked into a direct confrontation with the officer corps. With his customary agility, Gelinek observed on the 21st of May 1914, the Prime Minister sidestepped hostile interpellations in the Skupština by insisting that the Serbian government and the Serbian officer corps were in the fullest agreement on all important questions. In a report filed on the 21st of June, a week before the assassinations at Sarajevo, Gelinek summed up the situation in 4 points. The crown had fallen into the hands of the conspirators and was largely powerless. The army continued to pursue its own objectives in domestic and foreign policy. The Russian minister, Nikolai Hartwig, remained an exceptionally influential figure in Belgrade. But none of this meant that Pašić should be written off as a factor in Serbian politics. On the contrary, the founder and leader for 3 decades of the extreme Russophile radical party, still occupied, despite everything, an omnipotent position. Yet establishing direct communications with Nikola Pašić proved extraordinarily difficult. A curious episode from the autumn of 1913 illustrates the point. On the 3rd of October, Pašić paid a pre-scheduled visit to Vienna. The trip was timely because Vienna and Belgrade were locked in a confrontation over the Serbian occupation of parts of northern Albania. On the 1st of October, a letter warning Belgrade that the Serbs must quit Albania had elicited a non-committal reply. Accompanied by his ambassador, Pašić attended meetings with various Austrian ministers, including a lunch with the Austrian Foreign Minister Berthold, the Hungarian Prime Minister István Tízsa, Forgács, Bilinski, and others. Yet at no point was there a thorough discussion of the issue at hand. Bilinski, joint finance minister with special responsibility for Bosnia-Herzegovina, recalled in his memoirs that Pašić was an exceptionally evasive interlocutor. Full of fire and phrases, he parried questions from his Austrian interlocutors with waffling assurances that all would be well. Bilinski also faulted Berthold for failing to press the Serbian statesman harder. Small in appearance, with a flowing patriarchal beard, fanatical eyes, and a modest bearing, Pašić perplexed the Austrian foreign minister with his combination of graceful joviality and willful obfuscation. At the first meeting between them, before lunch, Berthold was so disarmed by the warmth of Pašić's overtures that when they came next to the topic of Albania, he omitted to press home the gravity of Austria's objections to the Serbian occupation. Sometime during the afternoon following their meeting, Berthold suddenly remembered that he had forgotten to inform Pašić of Vienna's strong views on the matter. It was agreed that he would broach the Albanian question with the Serbian leader that evening, when the two men were both expected to attend the opera. But when the foreign minister arrived a little late to take his seat in the royal box, he found that Pašić had already retired to his hotel, where he was supposedly in bed fast asleep. The Serbian prime minister left Vienna early next morning, without any further meeting having taken place. Berthold went back to his desk and spent the small hours writing a letter that was taken round to the hotel by courier so that it reached Pašić as he was leaving the city. But since it was scrawled in German script, not to mention Berthold's notoriously inscrutable hand, Pašić was unable to read it. Even when the letter was deciphered in Belgrade, Pašić supposedly found it difficult to see what Berthold was getting at. And the people at the Austrian Foreign Office had no idea either, because Berthold had not thought to preserve a rough copy of the text. This comedy of errors, assuming that Bilinski's recollection a decade later can be trusted, is no doubt in part an indictment of Austrian disarray, perhaps also of Berthold's almost painfully courteous diffidence and reserve, but it also hints at Pašić's famous elusiveness. Above all, it conveys a sense of the paralyzing awkwardness that had settled over Austro-Serbian relations by the eve of the First World War. What emerged from Austria-Serbia watching in the last years, months, and weeks before the assassination was a fairly nuanced account of the destabilizing forces at work in the neighboring state. This was a hostile and therefore a tendentious and one-sided picture, to be sure. Austrian observations of events in Serbia were embedded in a matrix of negative attitudes, rooted partly in experience and partly in long-standing stereotypes, about Serbian political culture and the prominent actors within it. Bad faith, deceitfulness, unreliability, evasiveness, violence, and excitability were recurring themes in the envoy reports from Belgrade. Conspicuously absent was a thorough analysis of the operational relationship between the Austrophobe groups within Serbia and irredentist terrorism within the Habsburg lands. It is possible that the fiasco of the Agram-Friedjung trials put brakes on Austrian intelligence gathering after 1909, just as the Iran-Contra scandals of the Ronald Reagan presidency in the 1980s led to a temporary scaling down of covert intelligence activity by U.S. agencies. The Austrians recognized that Narodna Odbrana aimed at the subversion of Habsburg rule in Bosnia and ran networks of activists in the Habsburg lands. They presumed that the roots of all Serbian irredentist activity within the empire led back to the pan-Serbian propaganda of the Belgrade-based patriotic networks. But the precise nature of the links and the relationship between Narodna Odbrana and the Black Hand were poorly understood. Nevertheless, the key points of reference that would shape Austrian thought and action after the events at Sarajevo were all in place by the spring of 1914. Hawks and Doves. The Balkan Wars destroyed Austria's security position on the Balkan Peninsula and created a bigger and stronger Serbia. The kingdom's territory expanded by over 80%. During the Second Balkan War, the Serbian armed forces, under their supreme commander, General Putnik, displayed impressive discipline and initiative. The Habsburg government had often adopted a dismissive tone in its discussions of the military threat posed by Belgrade. In a telling metaphor, Erentel had once described Serbia as a rascally boy pinching apples from the Austrian orchard. Such levity was no longer possible. A general staff report of the 9th of November 1912 expressed surprise at the dramatic growth in Serbia's striking power. Improvements to the railway network underway since the beginning of the year, the modernization of weaponry and equipment, and the massive increase in the number of frontline units, all financed by French loans, had transformed Serbia into a formidable combatant. It was very likely, moreover, that Serbia's military strength would increase with time. 1.6 million people lived in the new territories conquered by Serbia during the two Balkan Wars. In a report of October 1913, the Belgrade military attaché, Otto Gelinek, observed that while there was no cause for immediate alarm, no one should underestimate the kingdom's military prowess. It would, henceforth, be necessary, when calculating the monarchy's defense needs, to match all Serbian frontline units, man for man, with Austrian troops. The question of how to respond to the deteriorating security situation in the Balkans divided the key decision-makers in Vienna. Should Austria-Hungary seek some sort of accommodation with Serbia, or contain it by diplomatic means? Should Vienna strive to mend the ruined Entente with St. Petersburg? Or did the solution lie in military conflict? It was difficult to extract unequivocal answers from the multi-layered networks of the Austro-Hungarian state. Foreign policy in the empire did not emanate from a compact executive cell at the apex of the system. It emerged from interactions across an archipelago of power centers whose relationships with each other were partly informal and in constant flux. The General Staff was one such center, the military chancellery of the heir to the throne another. The Foreign Office on the Ballhausplatz was obviously a key player, though it really functioned as a framework within which competing policy groups jostled for influence. The dualist constitution required that the Hungarian Prime Minister be consulted on questions of imperial foreign policy, and the intimate connection between domestic and foreign problems ensured that other ministers and senior officials also laid claim to a role in resolving specific issues. Leon Bilinski, for example, the joint minister of finance with responsibility for the administration of Bosnia-Herzegovina, or even his theoretical subordinate, Governor Paturek, the Landeschef of Bosnia, whose views did not always accord with those of the minister. So open was the texture of this system that even quite junior figures, diplomats, for example, or section heads within the foreign ministry, might seek to shape imperial policy by submitting unsolicited memoranda that could on occasion play an important role in focusing attitudes within the policy-making elite. Presiding over it all was the emperor, whose power to approve or block the initiatives of his ministers and advisers remained unchallenged. But his was a passive rather than a proactive role. He responded to and mediated between initiatives generated by the loosely assembled power centers of the political elite. Against the background of this strikingly polycratic system, three figures emerge as especially influential. The chief of the Austrian General Staff, Field Marshal Lieutenant Franz Baron Conrad von Hötzendorf, the heir to the Habsburg throne, Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria-Este, and the joint foreign minister from 1912, Count Leopold von Berchtold. Conrad von Hötzendorf was one of the most intriguing figures to hold high military office in early 20th century Europe. He was 54 years old when he was appointed chief of the general staff in 1906, and remained throughout his career a steadfast advocate of war against the monarchy's enemies. In his views on the empire's external relations, Conrad was relentlessly aggressive. Yet he also entertained deep and sincere doubts about his fitness for office, and often toyed with the idea of resigning. He was shy in elegant company, and relished the solitude of walks in the mountains, where he produced melancholy pencil sketches of steep slopes shrouded in dark conifers. His tendency to self-doubt was reinforced by periodic bouts of severe depression, especially after the death of his wife in 1905. He sought an escape from this turmoil in his relationship with Gina von Reininghaus, the wife of a Viennese industrialist. Conrad's pursuit of this potentially scandalous liaison casts a vivid light on his personality. It began at a Vienna dinner party in 1907, when the two happened to be seated together. A week or so later, Conrad presented himself at the Reininghaus villa in the Opengasse and announced to his hostess, "I am terribly in love with you and have only one thought in my head, that you should become my wife." Taken aback, Gina replied that this was completely out of the question. She was bound by a sevenfold commitment in the form of a husband and six children. "Nevertheless," Conrad persevered, "I shall never rest. This wish will be my guiding star." A day or so later, an adjutant popped by to inform Reininghaus that, in view of the staff chief's fragile mental state, she should think twice before depriving him of hope. Conrad himself made a further appearance 8 days later, at which he declared that if she were to turn him down definitively, he would resign his post as chief of the general staff and disappear from public life. They reached an agreement. Reininghaus would remain for the foreseeable future with her husband and children. But should it appear opportune at some point to separate from her husband, she would keep Conrad in mind. The staff chief's bold gambit, a triumphant application of the cult of the offensive to the art of courting, had paid off. Gina was to remain with her husband for another 8 years. Exactly when she and Conrad started an affair is not known. Gina's husband, Hans von Reininghaus, was in any case a complacent cuckold. The wealthy businessman had other women to divert himself with, and the connection with Conrad proved welcome access to lucrative military supply contracts. In the meanwhile, Conrad visited his beloved whenever he could. He also wrote love letters, sometimes several a day. But since it was impossible to post them to his intended without risking a scandal, he collated them in an album bearing the title Diary of My Sufferings. Apart from scraps of news, the theme was consistent. She was his sole joy. Only the thought of her could lift him from the abyss of despair. His destiny was in her hands, and so on. In all, he accumulated over 3,000 letters between 1907 and 1915, some stretching to 60 pages in length. Gina became aware of the album's existence only after his death. It would be difficult to overstate the importance of this relationship. It was at the center of Conrad's life throughout the years from 1907 to the outbreak of war, eclipsing all other concerns, including the military and political questions that came to his desk. Its obsessive quality may help to explain some features of Conrad's professional demeanor. His willingness, for example, to risk his professional standing by associating himself with extreme positions, and his relative immunity from the fear of being exposed or discredited. He even came to see war as a means of gaining possession of Gina. Only as a victorious war hero, Conrad believed, would he be able to sweep aside the social obstacles and the scandal attaching to a marriage with a prominent divorcee. He fantasized in a letter to Gina about returning from a Balkan war draped in the laurels of triumph, throwing caution to the winds and making her his wife. Photographs taken of him during these years show a man fastidiously concerned with maintaining a manly, dapper, and youthful outward appearance. Among his private papers, now deposited in the Haus, Hof und Staatsarchiv in Vienna, can be found advertisements for anti-wrinkle creams cut from the pages of the daily press. In short, Conrad exemplified a brittle, rather overwrought form of European masculinity that was in some respects characteristic of the fin de siècle. Conrad approached the geopolitical predicaments of the Habsburg monarchy with the same monomaniacal fixity he brought to his love life. Even in the context of the pre-1914 European military commanders, he stands out as unusually aggressive. His answer to virtually every diplomatic challenge was war. In this, there was virtually no change between 1906 and 1914. Conrad repeatedly counseled preventive wars against Serbia, Montenegro, Russia, Romania, and even Italy, Austria's disloyal ally and Balkan rival. He made no secret of these convictions, but rather broadcast them openly through journals such as the Militärische Rundschau that were known to be close to the General Staff. He was proud of the immobility of his opinions, which he saw as an indication of manly solidity and steadfastness. "I am advocating here the position I have always maintained," was a favourite phrase in the letters and reports he sent to ministers and colleagues. Moreover, he favoured an abrasive, carping and self-righteous style of communication that irritated his colleagues and superiors. In 1912, when their affair was an established fact, Gina advised Conrad that he might get on better with the Emperor if he spoke mildly with the old man and avoided the method of cudgel blows. There were many potential enemies on Conrad's horizon, but Serbia became his chief preoccupation. In a memorandum composed at the end of 1907, he called for the invasion and annexation of Serbia, which he described as a constant breeding ground for those aspirations and machinations that aim at the separation of the South Slav areas of the empire. During 1908-09, when the annexation crisis was at its height, he called repeatedly for preventive war against Belgrade. "It is a crime," he told Gina von Reininghaus in the spring of 1909, "that nothing is being done. War against Serbia could have saved the monarchy. In a few years we shall atone bitterly for this omission, and I shall be chosen to bear the entire responsibility and drain the chalice to its dregs." He called for war against Serbia again during the Balkan War crisis of 1912-13. During the 12 months between the 1st of January 1913 and the 1st of January 1914, he counseled a Serbian war no fewer than 25 times. Underlying this single-minded pursuit of conflict was a social Darwinist philosophy in which struggle and the competition for primacy were seen as unavoidable and necessary facts of the political life between states. Conrad's was not yet a racist outlook, though there were certainly many younger Habsburg officers who envisaged a coming clash between the Germanic and the Slavic peoples, but rather a bleak Hobbesian vision of eternal strife between states bound to pursue their own security at the cost of all else. Until the outbreak of the Balkan Wars, Conrad's interventions were higher in volume than in impact. The immutability of his views itself undermined their credibility among the civilian leadership. Emperor Franz Josef flatly rejected his calls for preventive war against Serbia in 1908. Ehrenthal, too, remained impervious to his arguments and grew increasingly impatient at the staff chief's efforts to intervene in the policy-making process. By October 1911, when Conrad pushed hard for war with Italy, Ehrenthal had had enough and filed a formal complaint with the Emperor. Conrad, Ehrenthal wrote, had created a war party within the General Staff. If this development were left unchecked, it would paralyze the monarchy's capacity for political action. The conflict came to a head during a stormy audience with the Emperor on the 15th of November. Fed up with the obstreperous staff chief, Emperor Franz Josef summoned him to Schönbrunn for a dressing down. "These incessant attacks on Ehrenthal, these pinpricks, I forbid them," he told Conrad. "These ever-recurring reproaches regarding Italy and the Balkans are directed at me. policy, it is I who make it. My policy is a policy of peace. Everyone must learn to live with that. It is worth emphasizing this clash between the Habsburg Emperor and his chief of staff. A collision of this kind would have been unthinkable under Conrad's predecessors. It was a sign that the constituent bits of the Habsburg command structure were drifting apart, acquiring a partial autonomy that gravely complicated the process of decision-making. Completely undaunted by the Emperor's reproaches, Conrad busied himself preparing a trenchant reply, but Franz Josef dismissed him from his post before he had the chance to present it. His removal was officially announced on the 2nd of December, 1911. The most consistent and influential opponent of Conrad and his war policy was Franz Ferdinand, heir to the Habsburg throne, the man whose death at Sarajevo would precipitate the July crisis of 1914. Franz Ferdinand occupied a complex but crucial position within the Habsburg leadership structure. At court, he was an isolated figure. His relations with the emperor were not warm. His nomination as heir to the throne had come about only because the emperor's son, Crown Prince Rudolf, had committed suicide in January 1889. The memory of this gifted and brooding prince doubtless overshadowed the emperor's relationship with the abrasive and temperamental man who replaced him. Not until 5 years after his son's death was the emperor prepared to appoint Franz Ferdinand his presumptive successor, and only 2 years later, in 1896, did the Archduke become the definitive heir to the throne. But even then, the emperor's meetings with his nephew tended to be conducted in a tone of wounding condescension, and it was said that the Archduke went to imperial audiences trembling like a schoolboy on his way to the headmaster's office. The scandal of Franz Ferdinand's marriage to the Czech noblewoman Sophie Čotek in July 1900 was a further burden on his relationship with the emperor. This was a marriage of love contracted against the wishes of the emperor and the Habsburg royal family. Though descended from an elevated Bohemian lineage, Countess Sophie Čotek von Čotkova and Vognin did not meet the exacting genealogical criteria of the House of Habsburg. Franz Ferdinand had to wage a long campaign, enlisting the support of archbishops and ministers, and ultimately of Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany and Pope Leo XIII, in order to secure permission for the union. Franz Josef eventually gave in, but he remained unreconciled to the marriage until the couple's violent death in 1914. His heir was obliged to swear an oath excluding the as-yet unborn children of his marriage from the line of succession to the Habsburg throne. After the wedding, the couple continued to endure the slights of a Habsburg court protocol that regulated nearly every facet of dynastic public life. Sophie, forbidden ever to carry the title Archduchess, was styled First Princess, and later Duchess of Hohenburg. She was not permitted to join her husband in the royal box at the opera, sit near him at gala dinners, or accompany him in the splendid royal carriage with its golden wheels. Her chief tormentor was the emperor's chamberlain, Prince Montenuevo, himself the illegitimate offspring of one of Napoleon's wives, who enforced the rules of etiquette at every opportunity with exquisite precision. After 1906, when the emperor appointed his nephew Inspector General of the Army, Franz Ferdinand compensated for the long years of isolation at court by building a power base of his own within the rickety executive structure of the double monarchy. In addition to securing a number of key appointments, Aerenthal and Conrad, among others, the Archduke expanded the activities of his military chancellery, which was housed near his residence in the Lower Belvedere. Under the energetic supervision of a gifted head of personal staff, Major Alexander Prosch von Aachenau, the military chancellery was reorganized along ministerial lines. Its ostensibly military information channels served as a cover for political data gathering, and a network of friendly journalists managed from the Belvedere promulgated the Archduke's ideas, pummeled political opponents, and attempted to shape public debates. Processing over 10,000 pieces of correspondence per year, the chancellery matured into an imperial think tank, a power center within the system that some saw as a shadow government. Like all think tanks, this one had its axes to grind. an internal study of its operations, concluded that its chief political objective was to hinder any possible mishaps that could accelerate the national-federal fragmentation of the Habsburg Empire. At the heart of this concern about political fragmentation was a deep-seated hostility to the Hungarian elites who controlled the eastern half of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The Archduke and his advisers were outspoken critics of the dualist political system forged in the aftermath of Austria's defeat at the hands of Prussia in 1866. This arrangement had, in Franz Ferdinand's eyes, one fatal flaw. It concentrated power in the hands of an arrogant and politically disloyal Magyar elite, while at the same time marginalizing and alienating the other 9 official Habsburg nationalities. Once installed with his staff at the Lower Belvedere, Captain Brosch von Aranau built up a network of disaffected non-Magyar intellectuals and experts, and the military chancellery became a clearinghouse for Slav and Romanian opposition to the oppressive minority policies of the Kingdom of Hungary. The Archduke made no secret of the fact that he intended to restructure the imperial system after his accession to the throne. The key objective was to break or diminish the Hungarian hegemony in the eastern part of the monarchy. For a time, Franz Ferdinand favoured strengthening the Slavic element in the monarchy by creating a Croat, and thus Catholic, dominated Yugoslavia within the empire. It was his association with this idea that so aroused the hatred of his Orthodox Serbian enemies. By 1914, however, it appears he had dropped this plan in favour of a far-reaching transformation by which the empire would become a United States of Great Austria, comprising 15 member states, many of which would have Slav majorities. By diminishing the status of the Hungarians, the Archduke and his advisers hoped to reinforce the authority of the Habsburg dynasty, while at the same time rekindling the loyalties of the lesser nationalities. Whatever one thought of this program, and obviously Hungarians didn't think much of it, it did identify the Archduke as a man of radical intentions whose accession to the throne would bring an end to the habit of muddling through that seemed to paralyze Austrian policy in the last decades before 1914. It also placed the heir to the throne in direct political opposition to the reigning sovereign. The emperor refused to countenance any tampering with the dualist compromise of 1867, which he regarded as the most enduring achievement of his own early years in office. Franz Ferdinand's domestic reform program also had far-reaching implications for his views on foreign policy. He believed that the current structural weakness of the monarchy and the need for radical internal reform categorically ruled out an external policy focused on confrontation. Franz Ferdinand was thus adamantly opposed to the aggressive adventurism of Conrad. There was an irony in this, since it was Franz Ferdinand, in his role as chief inspector, who had hoisted Conrad into his general staff post, promoting him over the heads of many formerly better qualified officers. It was perhaps for this reason that the Archduke was widely, and wrongly, seen as the head of the Austrian war party. The two men did agree on some questions, the egalitarian handling of the nationalities, for example, and the pensioning off of elderly senior officers who seemed likely to disappoint in the event of war. Franz Ferdinand also liked Conrad personally, in part because the latter adopted a respectful and sympathetic attitude to his wife. The heir to the throne tended in general to judge people by how they treated the awkward fact of his marriage, and Conrad, for obvious reasons, was inclined to indulge the Archduke's unorthodox love match. But in the sphere of security and diplomacy, their views were worlds apart. Conrad saw the army exclusively as an instrument of modern warfare, and was fully committed to its modernization and preparation for the real conditions of the next major conflict. For Franz Ferdinand, by contrast, the army was above all a safeguard for domestic stability. Franz Ferdinand was a navalist, determined to consolidate Austrian dominance in the Adriatic through the construction of a fleet of dreadnoughts. Conrad saw the navy as a drain on resources that would be better invested in the military. "The most beautiful naval victory," he told the Archduke, "would not compensate for a defeat on land." By contrast with Conrad, Franz Ferdinand opposed the annexation of Bosnia. "In view of our desolate domestic situation," he told Aerenthal in August 1908, "I am, as a matter of principle, against all such power plays." In mid-October, perturbed by the furious Serbian response to the annexation in Serbia, he warned Aerenthal not to let the crisis come to a war. "We would gain nothing from that, and it rather looks as if these Balkan toads, egged on by England and perhaps Italy, want to goad us to a precipitate military step." It was all very well to give the Serbs and Montenegrins a dubbing, he confided to Brosch, but of what use were these cheap laurels if they landed the empire with a general European escalation and a fight on two or three fronts that it was incapable of sustaining? Conrad, he warned, must be restrained. An open break came in December 1911, when Conrad demanded that Austria-Hungary seize the opportunity created by the Libyan War to attack Italy. It was largely because Franz Ferdinand abandoned him that Conrad was dismissed by the Emperor in December 1911. Franz Ferdinand's most influential ally was the new Habsburg foreign minister Leopold Count Berchtold von und zu Ungarschitz, Fratting und Pulitz. Berchtold was a nobleman of immense wealth and fastidious taste, an urbane patrician representative of that landed class that still held sway in the upper reaches of the Austro-Hungarian administration. By temperament cautious, even fearful, he was not an instinctive politician. His true passions were for the arts, literature, and horse racing, all of which he pursued as vigorously as his wealth allowed. His willingness to follow a diplomatic career had more to do with personal loyalty to the Emperor and to Foreign Minister Aerenthal than with an appetite for personal power or renown. The reluctance he professed, when invited to accept posts of increasing seniority and responsibility, was unquestionably genuine. After transferring from the civil service to the Foreign Office, Berchtold served at the embassies in Paris and London before taking up a post at St. Petersburg in 1903. There he became a close friend and ally of Aerenthal, who had been ambassador to Russia since 1899. The St. Petersburg posting appealed to Berchtold because he was an enthusiastic supporter of the Austro-Russian Entente. He believed that harmonious relations with Russia, founded on cooperation in areas of potential conflict, such as the Balkans, were crucial both to the empire's security and to European peace. He derived great professional satisfaction from the fact that he was able, as Aerenthal's colleague in St. Petersburg, to play a role in the consolidation of good relations between the two powers. When Aerenthal departed for Vienna, Berchtold gladly accepted the ambassadorial post, confident in the knowledge that his own views of the Austro-Russian relationship were entirely in step with those of the new minister in Vienna. It was a shock, therefore, to find himself on the front line when Austro-Russian relations took a drastic turn for the worse in 1908. The first 18 months of Berchtold's new posting had been relatively harmonious, despite signs that Izvolsky was drifting away from the Entente with Austria towards a continental strategy founded on the new Anglo-Russian Convention of 1907. But the Bosnian annexation crisis destroyed any prospect of further collaboration with the Russian foreign minister and undermined the policy of détente in whose name Berchtold had accepted office. Berchtold deeply regretted Aerenthal's willingness to risk Russian goodwill for the sake of Austro-Hungarian prestige. In a letter to the minister of the 19th of November 1908, Berchtold offered an implicit critique of his former mentor's policy. In light of the pathological escalation of pan-Slav-influenced Russian national sentiment, he wrote, the further continuation of the active Balkan policy inaugurated by us would inevitably have a further negative impact on our relationship with Russia. Recent events had made his work in St. Petersburg extremely difficult. Another man would perhaps be able to find the charisma and warmth to restore good relations, but for someone of my modest capabilities, this seems the equivalent of squaring the circle. He closed with a request to be recalled from his post once the situation returned to normal. Berchtold would remain in St. Petersburg until April 1911, but his posting had become a burden to him. The conspicuous display of wealth that was characteristic of social life among the oligarchs of early 20th century St. Petersburg had begun to pall. In January 1910, he attended an immense ball at the palace of